Welcome to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. I'm your host, Kevin S. Fox, coming to you from Studio B in Radio Fabrik in Salzburg, Austria. Tonight's episode, our 32nd, we call it Hasta La Habana Siempre. And we look at North American geographical imaginations of the island of Cuba. Stay tuned. Fidel, Che, Buena Vista, Guantanamera, Guantanamo, Azúcar, Cigars, Rum, Communism, Makeshift Rafts, 90 Miles, Exiles, Teddy Roosevelt, Baseball, education, healthcare. These are all the, perhaps, images, the words that come to mind, maybe for some, maybe not for everyone, in the North American geographical imagination that is had for Cuba. In tonight's episode, we want to explore this imagination and sort of the duality that might exist. And tonight we welcome to the show Johnny Finn, Assistant Professor of Geography at Christopher Newport University in Newport News, Virginia. His research focuses on race, culture, and place, especially in Latin America. He's conducted extensive fieldwork in Cuba, Brazil, and along the U.S.-Mexico border, including a cumulative total of nearly 3 years in Cuba over the past 15 years. And over a year in Brazil. Based on his research, he's published numerous academic journal articles, book chapters, essays, photo essays, commentaries, and has conducted interviews in English, Spanish, and Portuguese. Beginning in 2016, in addition to his academic research, Finn has also begun leading educational trips to Cuba. And Johnny joins us from Virginia. Cuba is this really interesting place in the American imagination, the geographical imagination. And we wanted to spend time, I think, speaking with you a little bit because you've had a foot in both the United States and in Cuba for the last, decade probably?
More than that, 15 years.
15 years. Maybe we start. What was your first trip like 15 years ago? What inspired you to go to Cuba?
Yeah, so I my first trip, like you said, to Cuba was in January of 2002. I was an undergraduate student at the University of Missouri, and they had I was wanting to study abroad somewhere in Latin America. Studying Spanish, I'm a percussionist. I had been playing Latin American music, and I was really interested in kind of the Cuban Revolution, in Che Guevara, in communism, in socialism, and Cuba seemed like the obvious place to go. So I applied to go on the. Back then, they had, and they may still have. I'm actually not entirely sure, but I know they had several different programs where you could go to Cuba to study abroad. Kind of through an American university, but actually study at the University of Havana for a full semester. And so I applied, and after getting denied once, I finally got into this program to to spend a semester at the University of Havana.
Wow.
And so in that case, it was kind of complicated in the same way that, you know, any study abroad program would have been complicated. You know, paying tuition to a different university, getting transcripts, you know, sent back and forth.
Right.
But in terms of Cuba, the university, I went through Butler University, and Butler University had it all set up with the American government, with the Department of the Treasury, which manages the regulations and the embargo, and then also with the Cuban government. So it was really quite easy for us to kind of, we got an academic visa, we got permission from the U.S. government, we got an academic visa from the Cuban government, and we went right in and we were taking courses, like we were enrolled in normal courses at the University of Havana with Cuban students who were there. And that was, we did that for one semester, so for about 5 months. We were 4.5 months, 5 months we were there.
So you're there studying, doing a study abroad program. I mean, does it fulfill sort of the ideas you had about Cuba? I mean, because Cuba's, because of being an American and the difficulty normally, you know, that presents itself to get there, especially in the year 2002. Today it's a little bit different. I mean, was it this, you know, the idea that, oh, I'm going to go to, I want to go to this place that is really off limits. And is that part of the attraction?
Sure. I think the attraction for me initially was like, I kind of say kind of flippantly, it was like 50% drums and 50% Che Guevara. Right. So I was really interested in Cuban percussion. And as soon as I got there, I started taking percussion lessons. I continued, and we'll probably talk in a little bit. I ended up staying that first trip. I ended up coming back to the U.S. and going back to Cuba pretty quickly thereafter and staying for another 6 months or so.
Oh, really?
And taking percussion. Yeah. So most of the year 2002, I was in Cuba all the way into 2003, into early 2003. I ended up being there more than a year than that first, that kind of first, it was several trips, but back and forth to the U.S. And then at one point I had to leave Cuba and go to Mexico to get my visa renewed and then back to Cuba. But taking percussion lessons the whole time and then doing projects, kind of studying 20th century Cuban history.
Yeah.
Because I was really interested in the revolution. I was interested in, like I said, kind of the, all this kind of the leftist ideals of Cuba and the kind of leftist mythology that lives within within a lot of the discourse of Cuba and of the Cuban Revolution.
Yeah.
And I think in terms of it, you asked me if it fulfilled my imagination. And I would say, like, I went to Cuba for the first time 15 years ago, like really, like with a really kind of unproblematic, uncomplicated view of Cuba.
Yeah.
And it's just been a really long evolution of like understanding. And I think this, it sounds almost like a truism that it's more complicated than it seems. Like, of course, everything is more complicated than it seems. But in this case, like we're taught in terms of Cuba, we're taught that everything about Cuba seems to be within these two competing narratives, the narrative of kind of the socialist utopia or the communist dystopia. And I went very much thinking about conceptualizing Cuba in terms of this kind of socialist utopia in all these different ways. And I haven't gone to the opposite side of the communist dystopia. I think I understand that it's just a lot more complicated, and it's contradictory, it's dialectical. And in that sense, it's not unlike any place else in the world, frankly. Cuba is a place that I don't think a lot of Americans have a lot of experience with. We don't have in the U.S. a complicated understanding of Cuba, which maybe makes when people, like last summer when I took a group of 40 geography educators to Cuba, the whole time they were just kind of mesmerized and confused because it doesn't fit into their easy stereotypes, either from the left, from the more progressive view, or from the right, from the more critical view. And so I think for me, it's just been this evolution over the last 15 years of understanding more and more and more that it's really kind of complicated, which almost saying it now, it sounds kind of obvious, right?
Right.
So
part of that, like the socialist utopia, is that like access to education for more people than other countries? Is it access to healthcare, like even the U.S. might not have? Those the practical sort of pieces of that?
Yeah, so that's what people talk about all the time is the universal education, kind of socialized education system, including all the way through the university level, and the socialized medical system. And in both cases, I think people rightfully talk about on a macro level, the extremely positive outcomes in terms of education and in terms of healthcare. Cuba is in most health indicators on equal footing with the U.S., but it spends a fraction of what the U.S. spends in its healthcare system, and it's provided universally for everyone in the country.
Yeah.
And also in terms of, it's not just in terms of keeping their Cuban citizens healthy, it's also in terms of kind of medical research. They're doing really interesting work, and I can't talk in any detail about it because I don't know the work. I've just recently read a couple articles about this cancer vaccine research that's happening in Cuba that American medical scientists are going to Cuba to try to learn about this medical research that's happening in Cuba. So in that sense, like all of those things, but I guess what from now, my wife is Cuban, her whole family is in Cuba. I have a more of an kind of an on the ground I've had over the last, 15 years, more on the ground view where I've been able to see parts of Cuba that I think a lot of Americans don't, like the human interaction, for example, with the Cuban medical system is terrible. It's really uncomfortable. It's inconvenient. It's again one of those parts where I've said it's like I've realized, I've kind of understand that Cuba is more and more complicated than I ever imagined. It's one of those things, you go in and, I've known people who've had major surgeries.
Uh-huh.
They have surgery. It's a miserable process, but they live. And so, like, the outcomes measured on a macro level are very positive, but the interactions having to interact in an embodied form with this healthcare system is really pretty uncomfortable.
So it's the
that's the way for me. I think it's become like more similar in the education system. And I think the other way that this kind of myth or these competing narratives of utopia and dystopia, the third way that they play out is in terms of the environment. That on the one hand, people talk about Cuba as completely, organic and sustainable. And then on the other hand, they talk about Cuba as kind of reproducing the environmental degradation of the Soviet Union. And so a lot of my own research more recently has been more in that area, looking specifically at the Cuban food system and trying to get a clearer picture that goes beyond these kind of dueling narratives.
Yeah. You are listening to Geographical Imaginations. Geographical Imaginations is a growing multimedia public geography initiative designed to bring academic and everyday geographical thinking together. We believe everybody is a geographer and a co-maker of spaces. As an inquiry-based project, we ask questions and explore themes through dialogues with different texts and voices. Inevitably, our explorations return to simple yet complex questions, like how does blank inform the way I picture the world in my head? And how does that picture in turn limit or expand my place in the world? The main focus of the project is this hour-long radio essay program or radio essay expedition that's broadcast monthly from Radio Fabrique in Salzburg, Austria. In each episode, we make brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. We reflect upon our relationships with the worlds we inhabit and co-create. While many of the episodes deal with local and regional topics, themes are somewhat universal, and our investigations could inform the geographical imaginations of those living anywhere in the world. Now let's get back to our episode. You have, how many years now have you been bringing groups of teachers, geography teachers and social studies teachers from the U.S. to Cuba? Is this your third year this year?
No, so this is actually only my second year.
Second year, okay.
This summer will be my second year taking groups to Cuba. Last summer I took 40 geography educators and former educators, retired educators to Cuba. And this summer I'm taking, the groups are going to be smaller. There's going to be two groups of about 20 each. And if I may say, make a comment about kind of about those groups, it's funny because the first thing we arrived in Cuba last summer. And we come through customs, we cleared customs, we got our luggage, and we got onto the bus. And there, you know, we're such a big group, there's a tour bus waiting for us, the bus driver is there. There's also a tour guide, a Cuban tour guide, who works for the state tourism company,
right,
who was our guide the whole week we were there. And he introduces himself, and on this ride from the airport into town, it's about a 20 or 25 minute drive between the airport and like downtown Havana, where we were staying. He's giving kind of this introduction to Cuba, and he says, "Welcome to Cuba. Please, please, please don't even bother trying to understand." But kind of getting it, like he's very cognizant of the fact that Cuba is way more complicated than Americans have been, kind of, than our own kind of, than the American the hegemonic American geographical imagination.
Yeah.
And it was so funny because here we have a group of educators going to Cuba, and the first thing that the guide says is basically, "Don't even bother trying to understand."
And is this coming from his experience?
Go ahead.
Is this coming from his experience? So you're not his first group, right? He's seen the groups of educators who are now allowed to go into Cuba from the U.S., right? He's probably seen other groups, and he's just realized.
Yeah, he's worked with groups all over he had been a tour guide for 15 years.
Yeah.
He's worked with tour groups from all over the world. He does bike tours. He does all kinds of, you know, this definitely was not his first rodeo.
Yeah.
And I think he speaks from experience that it must be just an experience of Americans trying to figure it out, and probably not just Americans, trying to figure it out and just being completely befuddled by this really weird, I don't want to call it weird, but this really complicated, kind of contradictory dialectical place.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I cut you off before, but you were talking about the hegemonic narrative, or this geographical imagination that Americans have of Cuba, which there's probably a range, but that more dominant one is that, you know, it's the dystopia that you're talking about, the ills of communism, and the lingering sort of the residual effects of the post Cold War, kind of, you know, their connection to the USSR and all those things that sort of, I don't know, paint the negative sort of picture. I mean, is that something you're dealing with on the trips a little bit? I mean,
I deal with that a lot, and I think one of the first way that I deal with it is that when I take groups, and I'm doing it more this summer. Last summer I did it a little bit, but I'm doing it more this summer. I'm actually requiring them to do what effectively is a little bit of coursework before we go.
Yeah.
I'm going to assign readings. I'm going to have a couple of assignments for them, and then we're going to have a couple of webinars because I think.
Wow.
And this happened. I took a group of students, of undergrad students, a couple of years ago to Brazil, and it was the first time I'd taken students abroad. And you know, we learned lessons about how to do this. Like as educators, we learn about pedagogy and about education by actually doing it. So every time I teach a class, I'm always kind of making notes on what to do differently or do the same the next time around.
Right.
And the first time I took a group abroad was to Brazil, And we didn't do any preparation up front. It was a course that was purely, the plan was to purely teach it in Brazil. And I saw that the students, they missed a lot of kind of contextualization. They came in, we arrived into Brazil, and they were kind of clueless as to where we were even arriving. And so when I developed the Cuba trip last summer, I wanted them to do a little bit more work reading. So I assigned a couple of readings, but didn't do much more than that. But this time I'm almost going to teach like a 2 or 3 lecture course. So it's a tiny, like a, you know, just 2 or 3 lectures through a webinar platform.
Uh-huh.
But one of the things, and I do this, and this is kind of the long story to get to the point, the question that you were asking. I do this because the most common statement that I hear from people who want to go, who either are going on the trips that I'm taking, or who express interest, is they want to go to Cuba before things change.
Yeah.
And on its face, I think that's a deeply problematic perspective, because it assumes that things are not changing and are not always changing.
Right.
And I think that's the product of the American geographical imagination of Cuba as being frozen in time in the moment that the U.S. broke off diplomatic relations with Cuba in the early 1960s.
Yeah.
And it's built into our understanding and into our geographical understanding of Cuba as this kind of time capsule or a cultural relic or frozen in time, like all these kind of tropes that we hear of Cuba being stuck in the past. And then of course people start talking about the automobiles.
Right.
Oh man, we got to see all these old 1950s cars. And then they're a little bit disappointed when they get to Cuba, and sure they have the old cars, but most of the cars on the road aren't, you know, 1950s American cars. They're mostly I would say like a combination of equal parts old American cars, 1970s and 80s German and East German and Soviet cars, and then perfectly modern, mostly Asian cars that have been imported from South Korea or from China, or you know, but it's just so I've actually written recently an article that I titled "Cuba in Geographical Context" or "A Plea to North American Geographers Visiting Cuba," and it's all about challenging exactly that kind of notion of Cuba as frozen, because that's a frank. And the way I start the article is by saying this is on its face an ethnocentric perspective. Now, you can't blame people for having this perspective, but it is fundamentally an ethnocentric perspective. That is viewing Cuba through the lens of the U.S. rather than trying to understand and analyze Cuba on its own terms.
Yeah.
And so I set up the course, the trips that way, and that's, for me anyway, that's one of my main goals, is to try to encourage educators and geographers to understand Cuba on its own terms,
mm-hmm.
rather than maintaining and perpetuating this U.S.-centric perspective and U.S.-centric analysis.
Yeah. What about something like Buena Vista Social Club? What does that do for you? How does that fit into this freezing? Or does it try and... Is it almost like archaeological in the way...
Yeah.
Trying to
That's such a
find
good question.
The club and...
Yeah, it's so funny because Buena Vista Social Club, the music, I mean, I love the music. I love the multiple records that they put out in the 90s, and then in the time since then, a lot of the musicians from Buena Vista Social Club have gone on to have kind of almost encore musical careers that come after the Buena Vista Social Club. And the records are wonderful, and the musicians are incredible. Incredible as in really, really talented and just amazing musicians.
Right.
I think for all the kind of Ry Cooder, my view of Ry Cooder's involvement on the records is a little bit complicated, but Ry Cooder is also an amazing artist and producer, and the sound that they capture on, especially on the first couple of records, is just really amazing.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, 20 years on after the production of those albums, if you now, like, even, you know, more than 20 years beyond that first album being released, if you walk through Old Havana, you see a lot of, you know, young musicians kind of, what I've said this in the paper, just kind of rehashing or continuing to play, and kind of, and I've interviewed a lot of these musicians. They feel like they're stuck playing
those songs,
this music of their grandparents' generation that was made famous again in the 1990s, and that it's become how they can monetize a musical career. But it's almost become limiting in the sense that it doesn't allow, or it hasn't allowed them to develop beyond that.
Right. Yeah, that must be frustrating.
Yeah, I mean, I think, but I should also say that Cuba, let me just also be perfectly clear. Cuba also, amongst especially young musicians, I'm thinking musicians like from very young up to like in their 40s and 50s, there's also lots of different Cuban musical scenes, right? Different music scenes, whether it's hip hop, whether it's rock, whether it's Cuban jazz is kind of a uniquely Cuban spin on Latin jazz. There's really good stuff going on that's not the rehashing of the Buena Vista Social Club.
Yeah.
But in terms of, I think, what American is part of, if we're thinking specifically about the American geographical imagination, like, I think you can say that the Buena Vista Social Club is, in a sense, the soundtrack of that geographical imagination. And you definitely can see the result of that just walking through the tourist sections in Old Havana.
Yeah. I mean, is there a positive way, I guess, to think of Buena Vista in a sense? It is exporting something Cuban to the U.S. Does it soften the or you know, does something for the relationship. And I don't mean diplomatically necessarily, just the everyday person, the everyday imagination. And it's like, oh, wow, look at this. This is something rich coming from Cuba. Or is that just the uncomplicated way of kind of thinking about it?
No, I think you're onto something there. I mean, I haven't studied this question from the American perspective, so I don't have any kind of anything grounded in research to respond to that. But I think you're really on something, that it helps break down the
ice. Yeah.
Yeah, and it kind of in a sense humanizes Cuba and Cubans in the minds of Americans.
Yeah.
Although it becomes problematic when that's the only thing that kind of filters through into a mainstream American view,
popular,
right?
Culture. Yeah, right. Yeah.
So, but I mean, it's quite a difficult thing, because I've written very critically of Buena Vista Social Club.
Yeah.
I'll be the first to admit I've written at least one article that was, in retrospect, I might not have been so critical. But this was many years ago. I wrote this. It was, you know, an academic article where I kind of critiqued the cultural imperialism of the production of this album as being very much directed from the outside. And I think when I wrote that, thinking back about it, I don't think that I paid enough attention to the agency of the Cuban musicians in the production of that album. I focused heavily on a critique of Ry Cooder and the producer, I'm not even remembering his name, maybe Nick Gold, I think was his name, a producer from a record label in the UK.
Yeah.
And I was quite damning of them, and I think more so than I should have been, because in retrospect, I think what I did was my analysis and my critique had the effect of stripping away agency, like I said, from the Cuban musicians, as if they were just kind of bit players in this North American European capitalist conspiracy, right?
And appropriation.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And appropriation of, like, cultural appropriation in some ways, right? Like,
right. And it's one of those things that I think with more and more years, I just certainly there's the there's a problematic relationship of kind of North American capital or European capital and cultural imperialism, but it's the story is a lot more than that. The story is a lot more complicated than that. And so I think in my early critiques of the process of creating the Buena Vista Social Club record, I think I even played into that kind of essentializing and simplifying discourse surrounding the U.S. and Cuba. I played into those pre-existing narratives that I now critique, right?
Right.
So.
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Do you have an idea for an episode or want to give some feedback? Go to the comments section on the website or to the blog and enter into the conversation. Now let's get back to our expedition. So, yeah, I mean, I guess the music is in, you know, popular culture, folk culture in general, kind of these drivers of, you know, the things that get exported or imported into the United States, the things that are helping form this idea about Cuba. And not to mention the whole, you know, range of Cuban Americans that left in the late 50s, early 60s. And I guess another way we know Cuba, though, is through images and photography. Right. And I guess that's where people get this idea of the car, right? That they see so many pictures of the car, the old 1950s or, you know, U.S.-built car, that they make the assumption that everyone else, you know, everyone who has access to a car is driving that, right? So there's the power of the photograph is, you know, immeasurable in some ways, and how those photographs then enter into this sort of our conscious minds, and then we, you know, formulate these ideas about Cuba. You're involved in many different sort of photography projects. It's what you do apart from being an academic. You're a musician, you're doing photography. What do you want to, what are you capturing in the lens, and what do you want to show then in an American audience, let's say, or a Cuban audience even for that matter? What kinds of images are you choosing, and what kind of ideas do you want to communicate?
Sure, that's a really interesting question, and I think you're exactly right to say that, like, the medium of photography has been incredibly powerful. I mean, it always is. There's really kind of interesting moments in world history where, that kind of pivot on the importance of photography and telling some kind of story,
right,
and informing people. And in Cuba, I think the power of photography comes specifically from the fact that so few Americans, at least until the last couple of years, so few Americans have firsthand experience. Photographic evidence becomes kind of a substitute for firsthand experience.
Yeah.
And so then you have the subjectivities of, and the part of the, what's so interesting about photography is that it doesn't give away the deep subjectivities and deep kind of biases, whether they're conscious or unconscious, of the photographer in the image. The image pretends to be simply reality.
Yeah.
But the image is so subject to the biases and subjectivities of the photographer. And in that gap between the assumption of reality and the actual and the very subjective photographs of what they are, in that gap lies the ability, I think, of photography to tell a really, really wrong or kind of impartial at best story of Cuba, because right. It's true. You can, if you're in Cuba, if you've got a camera, you're one of the few, you know, the lucky few who can travel to Cuba,
right.
You have a really cool scene in a city that you want to shoot a picture of, all you have to do is stand there and wait for 5, 10, 15 minutes at the most to have a car drive by, and then you shoot the picture with the American car in the frame. And so it's not hard, and I've even caught myself doing it. It's not hard to even kind of subconsciously kind of make a cooler or more interesting picture by doing that. But the collective total of all photographers and of all travelers to Cuba shooting that same picture, it becomes a really a strong part of kind of discourse, teaching Americans about Cuba, right?
Right.
This image of the old American car. So that's all of that to say, basically, I agree with the premise of your question. So what am I doing to, in my own work? I guess I can talk about a couple of different projects. And
yeah.
I think what brings them all together is I don't think of my photography as a, like, I guess I've never thought of it kind of in a universal perspective. Like what I do, I'm an academic, I do research, I interview, I write, and then I kind of do photography along the way.
Right.
But along the way, I've had the opportunity to do a couple of gallery shows, including a solo show that I did of my work, of some of my photographic work from Cuba. And it's the solo gallery show of my work in Cuba I did is the one that's on my website.
Uh-huh.
And it's just called Cuba. It's called Cuba, A Portrait. And really, the short introduction that I give to it is basically that there are these narratives and that these kind of pre-existing narratives of Cuba, and that what I'm trying to do, while I'm perfectly cognizant of my own of the fact that I have my own subjectivities, what I'm trying to do is, you know, based on the fortune that I've been able to spend so much time in Cuba, probably 3 years cumulative over the last 15 years I've been on the ground in Cuba,
yeah.
is to try to go a little bit beyond, and it might just be a little bit, but at least a little bit beyond these kind of cliched images that perpetually reinforce these narratives of Cuba,
mm-hmm.
right? And so the project that I had this solo show on, it was really focused especially on rural Cuba, which is where I had been doing, and I still am doing a lot of research in central Cuba and the provinces of Sancti Spiritus and Villa Clara,
uh-huh.
which are two side-by-side provinces in central Cuba. It's a kind of a semi-mountainous region with a lot of tobacco growing and a lot of agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
Before you get out, if you continue east, to the middle of the island gets real flat and they have a lot of sugar cane.
Yeah.
But this is kind of in more, I would call it central western Cuba. It's kind of mountainous and so I've been spending a lot of time in my own research there on food and agriculture. In my research, I'm trying to use food as a kind of an analytical lens to study political economy and political ecology in Cuba without falling into the trap of these pre-existing narratives. Food almost becomes like this entry point,
mm-hmm.
to take me beyond these simplistic narratives.
Yeah.
And so the photographic work is just the work that came, the photography that came from working in rural Cuba on this one project focused on food for several years. And so that's really what that show is, and it's admittedly it's a narrow portrait of rural Cuba. It's only a kind of a narrow section of central Cuba. It's most of the people who live there now are descendants of immigrants who came in the early 20th century from the Canary Islands.
Right.
And so there, it's a racially, it's a whiter section of Cuba. So when I titled the show Cuba, A Portrait, in the introductory text that I gave to it, I made sure to point out that this is, in a sense, it's my portrait of Cuba. It's a portrait of my experience. So it's in a certain way, it's reflexive of my interaction and my intersection with Cuba and people and places and landscapes in Cuba. Hmm. It's not meant to be, and I really hope that people don't read it as my attempt at a comprehensive or representational view of all of Cuba.
Right.
So the second project, go ahead.
I was going to say, what was the reception? I mean, what kind of feedback, what kind of questions did you get from from your Virginia audience, who I assume none of which have been to Cuba, or maybe one or two?
Many of the people we have you're right. It was largely a audience that didn't have any connection to Cuba, other than what kind of the little that we hear about it.
Right.
And this was even before Obama, this probably nearly coincided with when Obama announced that he was first announced in 2014 that he was, easing restrictions. So Cuba wasn't so much, I think it was right before that. So Cuba wasn't so much in the news. It wasn't so much on people's minds.
Yeah.
And the reception was really interesting, I think, because I don't think the images were the stereotypical images. And I think that it gave, I hope anyway, that it gave kind of a more nuanced, more complicated view of Cuba. I have the photos in my office. I'm looking through them right now. and I don't think I had a single, automobile from the 1950s in the whole show. There was a couple of events, a couple of receptions, and it was quite positive what people seem to appreciate a different perspective and a more uncommon perspective in Cuba, although I'm not really sure.
Well, but it's new to them, so they're not comparing it to something. I don't think this gives the big picture. They're not thinking that in their minds. They're consuming it in some ways, or appreciating it, and maybe a better way to put it, just appreciating it and informing themselves of this, of rural Cuba, which they probably never have seen an image of it before.
I think that's right. And so in fact, and that makes me, even now thinking about it, makes me a little nervous that I become like the how they are forming their opinions of Cuba. Gosh, I hope I did a good job.
But as a tour guide too, I mean, being the leader, or at least the English speaking leader of the tour guide, and or the American, one, you're also framing, right? You're framing the experience to a certain degree, even if there's an attempt at not framing. There's still some. I mean, the description.
Oh, to be sure. Yeah, yeah.
It's pressure. There's pressure on you to. to share this other imagination.
I see part of my pedagogical aims.
Right.
As much with the tours as it is with the photography, is to try to get beyond like these. I find them analytically speaking, perhaps I'm being a little bit hyperbolic, but analytically speaking, I find them quite paralyzing, these narratives of Cuba as wonderful, Cuba as completely unproblematically
awful,
wonderful, like a la Michael Moore in the movie about healthcare systems.
Right.
And then equally on the other side as, this happens a lot with some members of the Cuban American community in South Florida that, there can be nothing positive said about Cuba. Because there, to them, there is nothing positive about Cuba. And I find those two positions really kind of, like I said, analytically paralyzing. And so as much as my photography, as in leading groups, and when I teach about Latin America and give some lectures in my classes on Cuba, it's really trying to get beyond that. From an analytical frame, and also just from kind of understanding, you know, facts about Cuba.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, where each month we venture into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode. What would it look like? How would one be received if they wanted to walk the length of Cuba and maybe document through photographs? How, you know, what's the reception of, you know, we'll flip it around. We've been talking so much about, I guess, how Americans are thinking about Cuba and how it enters into that imagination. What about the rural Cuban, and all of a sudden an American comes by with a backpack and two walking sticks, and what are they going to think?
I think they would think you're a freak, but no. To be quite honest, I think it would strike a lot of people as really strange, but I think people would have fun talking to you about kind of what you're doing, why you're doing it, and people would be, I think, very helpful to you along the way.
Yeah.
If you walked along the Carretera Central, the central highway that was built back in the 1920s and 30s to link Havana all the way to Santiago. Now, that's not end to end. That's not tip to tip.
Yeah.
But that's the bulk of the mileage from Havana to Santiago along the Carretera Central. And this is a two-lane blacktop highway that links small town to small town to small town into the provincial capital of most provinces along the way.
Uh-huh.
And back kind of winding through. This is since then, they've built, for a lot of the trip between Havana and Santiago, they've built the National Highway.
Uh-huh.
It's a big, several multiple lane highway that's like kind of straight and flat. And so if you're driving and you want to get there fastest, you go on the National Highway. But if you're walking and you want to meet people and see Cuba, you walk along the Carretera Central, or that's kind of the central, what they would call the central highway,
uh-huh.
as it winds through Cuba and links small towns to the provincial capitals. And you know, it's Cuba's hot, so you'd want to do it in the I would say you'd want to do it in the winter.
Yeah.
I don't know I've never done a long walking trip. How many miles per week do you cover?
Well, you know, a nice day of walking is 18 miles, maybe. And if it's pretty flat, you could probably do more. But I like the 18 to 20 kind of mile. If you're in good shape and it's flat, you could do more, maybe. But yeah, no.
So if you're doing 18, 20 miles, you know, you want to take a day off here and there, call it 100 miles a week, you'd be out on the road for many weeks.
Cuba's a
big island.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, take a couple of months.
I think so, yeah.
That would, I mean, it sounds like it would be something, it would be amazing to do. I think it would be really, really incredible to do that. And the people you meet along the way, the stories you would hear. I tend to not like essentializing Cubans, or I don't like to essentialize anyone. to say, oh, these people are this way and these other people are this other way.
Yeah.
But my experience in Cuba has been that people are very, you know, friendly and willing to talk, willing to engage. In terms of a question I hear a lot from Americans is like, do Cubans like Americans? And for all the antagonism between governments, I've very, very rarely felt any kind of outward antagonism between people.
Yeah.
Which makes having kind of exchanges nice and informative, educational, fun, and so on. That would be. I've talked with my wife about doing a road trip.
Yeah.
From tip to tip, but walking it. Would be just a completely different experience. Something that's more common in Cuba is to do cross-country bike trips,
yeah,
or at least by covering part of the country by bike,
uh-huh,
if not the entire country. That's increasingly common to see a group of cyclists out on the road cycling, but walking, I mean that's. I'm not sure if anybody's ever done it from tip to tip. I don't know. So, Kevin, you can be the first.
We'll start something new.
Yeah, right.
Well, we've come to the end of Hasta La Habana Siempre. We want to thank Johnny Finn for joining us from Virginia and sharing with us his insights after years of coming and going from Cuba and the United States. Also, I want to thank Johnny for really kind of pointing out, and this probably happens with many other places, and not just Cuba, but sort of what happens when our imagination of a place becomes so polarized, either the dystopia or the utopia. And we, again, want to thank Johnny for walking us through that and seeing how easy it is for us to accept, I think, these framings that evolve and are created by and reproduced by the media, politicians, whomever who's seeking a certain way of thinking about a place and the people of that place. And so here at the show, we want to sort of break through that and kind of seeing then how that mechanism works, that we could sort of unpack it. So thanks to Johnny for that. As always, thanks to Mike Allen for the song Sand Dune, which you could hear underneath my words right now. And stay tuned for the rest of the summer. We have a summer reading series that we're excited about, so check us out. Okay, ciao. Bye.